Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Cesar v. Keith. Mr. Legner?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Brett Legner. I'm an Assistant Illinois Attorney General, and I represent the State Board of Elections, Illinois State Board of Elections defendants in this matter. Your Honors, this Court should vacate or reverse and vacate the District Court's judgment that the prior version, the pre-amendment version of Section 5/19-8 of the Illinois Election Code was unconstitutional, and this Court should reverse the District Court's judgment that the plaintiff was a prevailing party in this matter. Turning to the first issue, Your Honor.
Could the party be a prevailing party even if they lost?
Could a party be a prevailing party even if they...
Let's say only half your relief is given, Mr. Legner. Suppose we were to vacate and, as you suggest, could there not still be a prevailing party?
There could be. It requires an analysis as to whether a significant portion of the plaintiff's litigation goals were accomplished.
Would this legislation have been enacted without the suit being filed?
That's an interesting question, Your Honor. I don't think it's necessarily a clear question. The answer to that is very clear.
Otherwise, it would be a very big coincidence, wouldn't it?
Well, that would be quite a coincidence. But the fact is that prior to the summary judgment order, legislation was pending to amend
the Illinois Election Code. But post the filing of the lawsuit, though, right?
Post filing of the lawsuit, certainly. But that alone is not a consideration anymore, insofar as that harkens back to the catalyst theory that was rejected by the Supreme Court in Buchanan. And prior to the summary judgment order, certainly, there was legislation underway to amend the election code. The theory here being that it may be that, due to litigation, maybe the General Assembly became aware of something or said, maybe we should change something. That doesn't mean it's constitutionally infirm, nor is that dispositive of the prevailing party inquiry. Turning back to the first point, which is mootness, Your Honors, the district court's judgment entered in July 2007 that the prior version of Section 5/19-8 of the Illinois Election Code was unconstitutional was moot at the time it was entered. The Illinois General Assembly amended the challenged provisions of the Illinois Election Code while the case was still pending. At that time, the challenge version, the pre-amendment version of the Illinois statute, was no longer before the court. The court could not issue a determination of that statute, of the constitutionality of that statute, which was no longer in the books, in a case such as here where only prospective injunctive relief was sought. This was not a case where there's a damages claim that required determination of the constitutionality of a since amended statute. Because the pre-amendment version of 19-8 of the election code was no longer on the books, the court did not have the authority of passing the constitutionality of it. That claim that the earlier version of the election code violated the Constitution became moot at that point. Now, Zesser, the plaintiff, suggests that his claim did not become moot because he continued to challenge the amended statute. But that doesn't really answer the question as to whether the pre-amendment version of the statute was moot. The fact is that once the statute was amended, he could challenge the new law, and that's a new challenge. But the prior version of the statute ceased to be before the court at the time of the amendment. It's further worth noting that the court declined to enter any judgment in favor of the plaintiff on the new statute, finding that the plaintiff did not show that the amended statute was constitutionally infirm. As such, the cases indicate that the entire action became moot at that point. Further, Zesser contends that there's no guarantee or that the state defendants or the defendants have not shown that the Illinois General Assembly won't simply reenact the prior version if this case is declared moot and the judgment is vacated. In making this argument, he switches the burden around. The defendants do not need to show that, for this issue to be moot, the defendants do not need to show that they will not reenact the statute. Zesser needs to show that there's some likelihood, that there's a reasonable likelihood, that's reasonably likely, that the state will reenact the prior version of the statute.
Did the court some references made to the record, what the court said? I don't have all of that. We just have the orders and stuff. Was there something more that the court was considering when while this action was going on? What the legislature was doing? Did the court take notice of what the legislature was doing? Did it have a reason to say, well, I want to make sure this doesn't happen again? Or was there anything like that that interjected that's maybe not in the order?
Not overtly. What happened was, after the initial partial summary judgment order was granted, the court said, you know what, at this point, we're going to let the parties submit ideas to create a new scheme.
That was after his decision that it was a violation of due process, though, wasn't it?
That's correct.
So he wasn't done, obviously.
He was not done at that point. That's exactly right.
He'd at least come to that point.
He'd come to that point, but he was not done. And in fact, at that point, shortly thereafter, there was shortly after the summary judgment ruling, there was an election, a primary election in Illinois, and the plaintiff tried to enforce the partial summary judgment order so that the primary election was conducted under different rules, and he was denied that relief. The court declined to issue any relief. In other words, that election was conducted under what at that point had been, you know, considered constitutionally infirm.
In other words, the court didn't interject in that one.
No, the court did not interject in that one at all. That election was carried out under the challenged version of the statute.
Had the defendants sought that input into ideas after the partial summary judgment ruling was made, anticipating the legislation or looking for delay for that to happen?
No, the defendants did not delay for that to happen. In fact, all the defendants moved. The court asked to let them take an immediate appeal because they did not believe, and they continued to not believe,
under 1292B or?
Yes, and the district court denied permission to take an appeal. The defendants wanted to immediately appeal the interlocutory declaration of constitutional infirmity. So they weren't delaying, they wanted to appeal that. Then it was the court on its own motion to allow the parties to submit the schemes. Now, what happened is, while that was pending, the Illinois General Assembly came up with its scheme as a further amendment to a bill that had been proposed long before the summary judgment order had been entered. But but the defendants didn't ask for the court to, proposals to amend it, to allow the General Assembly to basically moot the case, as was the case in Palmetto, for instance, where the defendants told the court, please don't enter a final judgment. We're going to go ahead and repeal the statute. And part of that distinction highlights another important distinction in this case, which is that these defendants, the Lake County Clerk and the Illinois State Board of Elections members and officials, are not the Illinois General Assembly. They certainly don't have control over what is proposed or what is enacted by the Illinois General Assembly. And the case law is clear that these are, in fact, two different bodies, the legislative branch and these executive branches. And so the actions of the legislative branch aren't attributable to these executive defendants. And that's not clear in Palmetto, for instance, that there was that arm's length nature, that arm's length separation between the parties who asked, for a delay in the entry of final judgment, and who actually amended or repealed the challenged ordinance in that situation.
What happened after the General Assembly amended? Was that July 6th or something like
yes.
that?
Yes.
And then this ultimate decision didn't come down until well into 07, as I recall.
The final judgment was entered in June 2007.
And so there was another election, obviously, and the court took that into consideration as to how many problems there were, et cetera.
That's correct. There was the November 2006 election, and the court declined again to grant any interlocutory injunctive relief and let the election proceed under the as-amended election code rules that were in effect at the time, which the plaintiff was still challenging. The plaintiff certainly contended that it did not satisfy his constitutional rights. But, again, the court denied relief.
Well, this would certainly be different than Palmetto, where it was a precise issue that the counsel had to deal with. And instead of letting the judge or asking the judge to continue the case while they cured the problem rather than the judge coming in and curing it, and that's what happened. It was an exact issue. I guess it was whether or not this being a certain distance from
correct
a forest reserve or something rather. And they
correct
took that out. And that was the only infirmity that the judge saw, and therefore that was the end of the case.
That's correct. That
now,
was quickly easy to
distinguish that with this one. I assume it's because, first of all, the plaintiff wanted much more. And
correct.
Secondly, that the judge did not, after reviewing everything, concluded that at least whatever, he was not going to rule that unconstitutional.
That's correct.
So there was a sharp distinction between what ultimately, when the opinion came down. So I guess the only question is why he would have said that it was unconstitutional and why this isn't moot, I guess.
You know, and again, that's a good question. When the General Assembly amended the statute, the defendants moved to dismiss the case as moot at that time, and the district court denied that motion on the ground that it felt that there may be constitutional questions not answered by the amended statute. The court wanted to see how the amended statute played out. Now, you know, it is certainly our theory that raises sort of a different question, because once there was an amendment, the earlier version is no longer before the court. Now, the plaintiff is free to challenge the amended version. The plaintiff did challenge the amended version and continues to challenge the amended version. That's fine. Insofar as that's a separate action or a second phase of this action, a second part of this action, that's fine, but they certainly didn't get any relief on that phase. But the question as to whether the challenge to the earlier version of the statute was moot, I agree. It was resolved at the time of the amendment, and at that point, that challenge should have been dismissed.
Well, if not moot, it all comes down to the issue of prevailing party, doesn't it?
That's right. That's exactly right. And, you know, by the time the final judgment was entered, they had a ruling, a declaration of unconstitutionality on the statute that had been moot for almost a year at the time the final judgment was entered, and they had never actually received any meaningful change from the court in the way any election was conducted as a result of that interlocutory partial summary judgment order. The first election was conducted under the same old rules, and the second election, the November 06 election, was conducted under the amended rules that the plaintiffs continued to challenge as being constitutionally infirm.
Mr. Legner, if we could just stay with Palmetto a second. In your brief, you suggest that a prevailing party requires a consideration of what relief the plaintiffs obtained prior to mooting of the case. Is it your position that there's an impossibility here that any relief was obtained prior to the mooting in here? Or is it just insufficient, the amount of relief, if we were to quantify it in this case?
Under these particular facts, you know, the amount of relief at the very least would be insufficient. But more likely, I think the better characterization is that they did not actually obtain a change in the legal relationship between the parties with a sufficient judicial imprimatur, because the world did not change.
Could you have been successful during that period in obtaining a dismissal of a lawsuit?
During which period, Your Honor?
Prior to the mootness.
Prior to the mootness. Prior to the mootness, we were not successful in obtaining a dismissal of the case. That is true. The court found that at least the case should, you know, go forward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but again, an interlocutory ruling along that nature did not, you know, change the actual world in which the parties lived. No election was conducted differently as a result of that.
Well, I'm not going to hold out the possibility a special election could have occurred, but
I understand
your position.
And again, the primary election did occur after the partial summary judgment order, and it was conducted under the old rules. Your Honor, if you have no further questions for me, I'll turn it over to my co-counsel. Thank you very much.
Mr. Jessica?
May it please the court, counsel. Daniel Jassica on behalf of Lake County Clerk Willard Helander. The trial court erred by finding the former section and provisions of the Election Code unconstitutional because they failed to provide an opportunity for a rejected absentee voter to contest and rehabilitate the ballot prior to the final canvass of votes. The district court's error was twofold. It failed to properly analyze the Election Code provisions at stake at that point in time, November of 2004, and it summarily concluded that simply because an in-person voter has an opportunity and processes available to him if the election judges challenge his ability to vote on election day, that it necessarily follows that a rejected absentee voter has the same or similar due process rights. In fact, no due process interest is implicated when an absentee voter's application is rejected under the provisions then in effect in November of 2004. Everyone agrees that absentee voting is not protected by the Constitution, required by the Constitution, and the state could require everyone to vote in person, prohibit all absentee voting without running afoul of the Constitution. The significance of this fact is that unlike the fundamental in-person right to vote, any due process interest that arises out of the rejection of the absentee voter's ballot arises out of a state-created protectable due process interest, if any, not out of the Constitution, not out of the due process clause itself. And therefore, the starting and ending point for the analysis of whether there's a protectable due process interest is to review the legislation in effect at that point in time.
Just from a practical standpoint, though, there are a lot of people who do rely on absentee ballots for not lack of access, or in the military, people who do have two residences and that sort of thing. And it's a little hard to say, well, you're at risk if you vote absentee. Your vote may not count.
Well, I think the legislature and this court has previously recognized that there's a balancing act, and it's properly left to the legislature to determine what's the benefits of increased voter participation through allowing absentee voting and making sure that those very real and recognized risks of increased voter fraud are addressed in whatever scheme is designed to provide for that absentee voting. So, yes, absolutely there is a risk. The legislature has recognized that risk and tried to come up with a set of rules that accommodate both interests. The question in determining whether there's a state-created due process interest turns upon whether, when the election judges rejected the absentee ballot, were they distinctly altering or extinguishing some pre-existing right, in which case, or status, in which case there would be a protectable due process interest, or were they dashing the unilateral hope and expectation of an absentee voter, in which case no due process interest is implicated. To look at the election code provisions in play in November of 2004, those provisions provided that up until the time the election judges conducted their review of the application, that's all that person was, is an applicant seeking to vote absentee. They submit the application, they submit the ballot, the election authority forwards those on election day to the election judges, who at the end of the polls have closed, in-person ballots have been counted. They then turn to the absentee ballots, and they turn to the application. They're given the application to review, and under Section 19-9 of the Election Code, they do a consignature comparison to make sure that the signature on the application matches the signature that the election authority has in her records.
Now, some of those signatures envelopes have been there for a couple of weeks, haven't they?
Yes. No, not with the election judges. They've come into the election authority.
But somebody gets them, and this is sort of whimsical, but why can't somebody be comparing these signatures a lot sooner than election night? But I guess that's another issue.
Well, under the statutes, it's a task left to the election judges, and the election judges obviously are only convened that one day for the election, and so they are the ones who at the end of the polling receive the absentee ballots and review them. And they're the ones under Section 19-9 who are determining that the applicant, again that word throughout the election code, the applicant is a duly qualified elector in the precinct, and that the application and the ballot haven't been tampered with, and that the certifications on the application are properly executed. What this demonstrates, I think, is that throughout the process, the state legislature didn't bestow some status or some entitlement upon the absentee voter merely by giving them the application. That is done by the election judges when they review and either accept or reject the application on election night. I would contrast this with other instances where courts have found there to be, you know, a pre-existing status that is then extinguished, such as once the state has conferred upon someone a driver's license, you can't terminate that status without due process. Once someone has become obtained parole status, you can't terminate someone's parole status without providing due process. But that's a very different scenario here than where the election code sets up that someone is simply applying to hopefully be able to cast their absentee ballot.
I guess you would compare that to the person who shows up would have the same scrutiny as that envelope did on a signature. Is that right?
If someone showed up in person on election day, well, I think that...
Could they be rejected because for the same reasons that the person was rejected on the envelope?
They could be rejected, but because in-person voting is a fundamentally recognized right, they would, under the Constitution, be afforded due process rights. The distinction here is that these rights of an absentee voter don't arise under the Constitution. They arise, if anywhere, out of the state-created privilege that they've granted them. So if you did show up, you are given an opportunity to prove your identity in person by providing two forms of identification. But I think it's misplaced to compare the processes that are afforded to a in-person voter who has a fundamental right to cast an in-person vote with the processes that are necessarily available to someone who is taking advantage of a state-created privilege.
Thank you, Ms. Jessica. Ms. Krislov?
Thank you, Judge Fong, Judge Mannion, Judge Tinder. Judge Tinder, I haven't had the pleasure before. We have three issues: merits, mootness, prevailing party. On the merits side, the confusion is, for want of a neutral term, the reason that absentee voters didn't get notice or opportunity to be heard to defend their vote was because the procedures that Lake County had, although the election judges filled out these postcards advising people on the night of the election that their absentee ballot had been rejected, those postcards, instead of being dropped off at the mailbox or the post office that evening or the next day, so that people would have had the opportunity to do something during the ensuing 14 days before the official canvass would occur, were instead put in the red bag which goes to the storeroom. Due process requires timely notice and an opportunity to be heard. Lake County deprived the voters, the absentee voters, of timely notice by the simple act of dumping these postcards in a bag which would go to storage rather than just dropping them off at the post office on the way back to the county clerk's office. The statute did not provide an opportunity to challenge the disqualification at that time, and never until we brought the case and Judge Core granted summary judgment, denied the defendant's motions for summary judgment, and granted our motion for summary judgment, finding that due process had been denied absentee voters by lack of timely notice and opportunity to be heard. And although there are lots of pending bills going before the Illinois state legislature at any given time, some are there just as vehicles to put in eventually whatever somebody decides ought to go in there, the fact of the matter was that the provisions that were added to that election code bill were not only not added until after Judge Core's grant of summary judgment to us, but were explicitly done, as Senator Link said, and this is in Exhibit B to our brief, there will also be changes in the when a person votes an absentee. This comes from a court case held in Lake County. They'll have a 14-day period in which they can contest this result. And if you notice at page 37 of our brief, the election code bill proceeded through and was amended a couple of times before summary judgment was entered in this case, all those times without any provision dealing with absentee ballots at all. It was only after summary judgment was entered and Judge Kaur had said, I want procedures proposed, that somebody got the bright idea. I mean, one thing to violate people's civil rights, but darn, it's another thing to have to pay attorney's fees for that. And so it was only after summary judgment was granted to us that a provision was put in this bill moving through that required notice and an opportunity to challenge.
Well, it might have been a reaction, but it wasn't a direction of the judge or a threat or anything. It just somebody savvy enough to say, hey, let's get on this while the judge is proceeding in court. But it may have been inadvertent, but I think that certainly is different than at least Palmetto. Now, maybe it's in between that and the Supreme Court somewhere, but...
Well, the state's response really was to say, instead of proposing procedures, we've now stuck the thing in the bill, and it'll be passed, and that'll deal with the situation.
That was the argument to the court?
Yeah. Yes.
When was that?
Well, the procedures were supposed to be submitted by May 1st. The amendment to the bill was not until...
July has passed.
And the bill certainly wasn't enacted until July 3rd. And Senator Link's statements, if you will, link the change specifically to this case. And I don't think in good conscience that they would deny that was the result. The importance of... And as to mootness, I listened to Mr. Jessica, and I think, well, they're arguing the merits of this. The case can't be moot as long as one of the defendants appears to be still arguing the merits. And whether that's a contrived...
That can't be the standard for mootness.
Pardon?
Can't be the standard for mootness.
Well, in terms of you know, if the roles were reversed and it were the state arguing what the county is arguing and the county arguing what the state is arguing, which would make sense logically, because the state would say, on the merits, the first statute was fine, the second statute's fine, everything's been fine, is fine, will be fine. And the county would say, it's all moot. We followed the law the last time, we're following the law this time, it's all moot. The importance of this is especially, and the other aspect that the case is not entirely moot, deals with the issue of the procedures in the statute require an in-person presentation for absentee voters to challenge their disqualification of their ballot. And there are two situations where this is fundamentally unfair. One is, obviously, soldiers, sailors serving on active duty. They cannot appear in person. Nobody's going to grant them leave to come back for that. That's not what we want. The other thing is that Lake County, for example, has a whole list of what they call snowbirds, which are people who have not only second residences, but are well-established second residences that they send out an absentee ballot application to those people as a matter of course every year, whether they ask for it or not. The other part of this, and what makes this so fundamentally important to protect those rights, is both the ease with which those rights could be protected, literally by just mailing the postcards rather than storing them.
How would that address, for example, military people who are...
Military people, well, the military people could provide, well, the postcard may or may not, you know, whether or not that gets to them sufficiently. 2 weeks is probably not out of the range for somebody even on active duty, even
statewide, stateside, but that would be a real challenge, would it not, for someone abroad?
Well, 14 days will accept, I guess, for the purpose of this argument, is the time in which the canvass cannot occur before that. So 14 days is sort of the window of opportunity. Anybody that gets the postcard within that time could very easily provide, and certainly somebody who's in active duty in Iraq could certainly be able over the internet to provide a copy of their military ID that would say, that's my signature, that's my ballot. And indeed, what happened in the election that proceeded, following the amendment. And what happens is roughly one person per precinct has their absentee ballot rejected statewide. Turns out to be hundreds, more than 1,000. In that election, every single person, everyone who got notice and chose to defend their ballot, had their ballot counted. Now, that seems sort of obvious to think that nobody's going to go in and defend their signature if it's not really them. But the fundamental ease with which this has occurred is that the cure is very easy, the deprivation is severe, and although one would say Bush versus Gore is a good example of making sure that every vote counts, there are county, city, and village elections throughout every time where the election is decided by merely one vote.
Well, a new statute addresses this, right?
The new statute addresses this. The only place that it falls short is affording an alternative reasonable means. We don't care a lot how the hearing occurs. All we want is a method that somebody, and mostly these are merely signature. All you have to show is two, and we found fascinating, you know, interesting. Everybody goes off to college, changes their signature a little bit, establishes their individual identity. Or people register to vote when they turn 18 or when they turn 21, and by the time they're 75, they may have voted in every single election, but their signature has changed. Those people should be given the opportunity, even if they can't make it in, if they can provide a reasonable means in the Board of Election Authority, that election authority, so that looks like their current driver's license, that's their current signature, that's the person, the address matches. It's a very easy process.
So are these are concerns you have with the new statute?
This is the concern that we have with the new statute.
Judge Kaur declined to address those.
Right.
You didn't appeal those, that ruling, though, did you?
We raised that. I think it's raised. It's raised by the record, and I think we addressed that in the brief. We've been focusing on the other aspects at this point, but I believe it is raised in the brief.
Whether or not that carries a day, what about the benefit issue, the Palmetto question?
There's no question that we were prevailing party under Palmetto. It would not have. This was, in fact, Palmetto is where you challenge a regulation and somebody gets rid of it in the meantime. This is not merely just getting rid of an offending provision. This is an affirmative action to establish a set of procedures. Following the judge's order to come up with a set of procedures, the state's proposed set of procedures was to enact a statute. That's their proposed procedures.
And you would say that the legislative record as reflected by the senator's comments are sufficient to establish the tie to...
Not just the senator's comments, but also the timing of the particular amendment. That the amendment was put into a bill that had been amended two, possibly three times. At page 37 of the brief, it describes exactly what amendments had occurred. No amendments in this respect had occurred until after the judge's order.
But that just seems to be, it's consequential. It's like, I don't want to make any slight comparison, but this court ruling does have an impact, but it's collateral. It's not a direct order or dealing with it directly, as was in Palmetto, where this was a direct situation. And I think if you look at the Supreme Court case and how it Buchanan whatever I think this falls in between it somewhere. It's not ironclad by any means.
I believe it doesn't, Judge Mannion, because in the legislative history, there's all sorts of interesting things that you stumble upon in a case. But Senator Susan Garrett's daughter had her ballot rejected, disqualified, on the same basis, person goes off to college, changes their signature a bit, gets rejected. And Senator Garrett brought up the issue before the legislature. Bill went nowhere. Nothing happened. And it was only after summary judgment had been entered. And summary judgment
Hold on a minute there. Summary judgment being entered, it's not a final judgment, though. You couldn't have enforced that, could you? In fact, you tried to seeking injunctions related to the primary and then the general election and were unsuccessful.
Well, the problem that occurred was, first, it is a ruling on the merits. That's one thing that whether it's a final, it is not a final judgment in the sense of Rule 59, I believe.
I think it's 58.
58, but I'm close. in concept, it's it was not a final judgment in that respect, conceded. However, what had happened was we had mentioned the possibility of a stay. Judge Kaur said, because they were not, he felt that for whatever reason, where the state wasn't, he didn't feel they were cooperating, he said, go ahead and request your stay. Now, what had happened in the meantime was that the federal election was occurring, and in, I believe, the Ninth Circuit, they had enjoined the election from proceeding except with certain new procedures. And I think it had to do with the driver's license, whether you had to show two forms of identity in California in order to be able to vote. And the Ninth Circuit enjoined the state from putting these requirements into effect. And the Supreme Court vacated that and indicated that the election should proceed at this point to get a feel for what the effect of it was. And that's why Judge Kaur did not enjoin them at that point.
Now, is that on the record?
Well, it is in the sense that the transcript of Judge Kaur's ruling and the fact of the Supreme Court's ruling, it's in the record, but it's not in it in that fashion. I mean,
is in our record. The record submitted.
It is supported by the document. It is shown by the documents in the record because the judge's denial of the injunction comes literally days after the Supreme Court.
I'm not looking for the result. I'm looking for the reason.
His reason mimicked his stated reason, basically followed the Supreme Court's, and his statement, it should be in the, I'm sure it's in the transcript, but...
is that before us? Do we have that?
That issue isn't really raised. I mean, the record is there, but the issue... is not really raised because the that aspect.
Well, it's
that aspect wasn't explicitly raised as part of the disputes.
Could you have appealed his denial of the stay?
We could have, but frankly, because of the Supreme Court's ruling that vacating California, imposing new procedures in the meantime. We figured was unlikely to be successful either in the interim. Yeah,
these summary judgment rulings are sort of ethereal things. Until judgment is actually entered, I wonder what value that had. Did that really change the relationship between your plaintiffs and the defendants?
Well, there's ethereal and there's ethereal, I suppose. But had their summary judgment been entered, that would have... And the case not completed. I mean, supposing their summary judgment had entered and the case been found moot, there still would have been the attorney's fees. Now, we could have appealed from the court's decision, but in that fashion, the summary judgment, I mean, I would beg to differ. The summary judgments are not like maybe rulings on interim motions. The grant of summary judgment is a you win on the merits decision.
Until you can file that notice of appeal, there's really or enforce the judgment, there's not much you can do with it.
Well, but you know, I suppose the one issue is what should we have done at the time? If the likelihood of getting an injunction against the from this court would have been very small, considering that the Supreme Court had directed vacating California's, the Ninth Circuit's ruling that the state had to vacate its procedures that it had enacted. I suppose that would, to put that prevailing party to be based on that, I think is harsh and does not encourage people to bring these cases in the future. I mean, one of the things that is a concern is there has to be the incentive. I mean, if we depend, we found that just depending on everybody's pro bono efforts doesn't really work terrific. That the Congress has decided that there is a reason to provide attorney's fees to prevailing parties, because in order to have these cases be brought, somebody like Mr. Zesser, who was determined to find somebody to pursue this, these cases are generally brought on contingent fee or by some group, and nobody wanted to do this. We took it. We won. They changed the law. They wouldn't have changed it without that.
And well, often people go before the legislature with these same type of people, and they go to their constituency. Maybe one senator is stronger than another, but when you get into a legislative situation and have hearings, this is important to voters and everyone else. It's not necessarily something that has to be done through the courts. Coincidentally or directly, whichever way this ends up, it was also addressed in the court and in the legislature.
But there's nothing like a summary judgment ruling by a federal judge that this violates people's civil rights, and that the possibility may exist that if they don't moot the case, they're going to have to pay legal fees. I mean, that is, however you may view the way this proceeded, the fact of the matter is we think that we have demonstrated I think we've demonstrated that this is not no coincidence. They related to the case. It was amended instead of submitting procedures, and we have satisfied that. If you require an admission that we're only doing this because the federal judge has ordered the state to provide procedures, I think you would be asking too much. With that, we would ask that the judgment below be affirmed that on all counts, merits, mootness, and prevailing party.
Thank you, Mr. Krisloff.
Thank you.
How much time, Mr. Legner? Mr. Legner, you had extensive questioning, and we obviously went into your rebuttal, so I will allow you 2 minutes.
Your Honors, I'd like to make a couple quick points. First, I want to clear up what I think may be some confusion as to the timing of the amendment. The district court entered its partial summary judgment order and asked the parties to submit proposals. After that had been asked, a while after that, the defendants came into the court and said, "Court, the General Assembly is now taking a look at it. Perhaps you want to wait for the benefit of to see what the General Assembly has done." But it's certainly not the case. In fact, it's a misstatement to indicate that the defendants stuck those provisions in there in a way as to moot the case. These defendants had nothing to do with it. The Illinois General Assembly acted, the legislative branch acted, not on the instruction or at the request of any of these defendants, as opposed to a Palmetto case, and not doing anything that these defendants asked them to do. The counsel seems to think that all public officials are fungible, and that when the General Assembly moots a case, it does so to avoid paying fees. The General Assembly doesn't have to pay fees. The General Assembly wasn't on the hook for fees. In this case, the late county clerk and the state board members are the ones that have to pay fees, but they're the ones that had no part in mooting the case. If you want to talk about the equities of the case, there is the equities. Where the equities lie there, where there's a partial summary judgment, the General Assembly acts quickly, but for the defendants can appeal, which they tried to do, they tried to take immediate appeal of that order, and yet are left in this situation.
Mr. Legner, would you at least agree, or would you agree, that the entry of a summary judgment, and obviously keeping in mind the accurate observations of Judge Tinder, judicially sanctions a change in the relationship of the parties? apart from appealability now, I mean, is that a change in relation? And obviously I'm asking this to see whether we reach this threshold for attorney's fees. I'm not speaking about merits or mootness.
No, I understand that. The entry of summary judgment could, depending on what the summary judgment did, what was in that motion, to what extent it resolved a case, and that had a meaningful effect.
I understand the finality of it. I guess I'm just, you know, sort of in basketball terms, where's the possession arrow pointing at that point in the game?
At that point in the game, the possession arrow, I would certainly like to say it's a jump ball, but at that point in the game, at the entry of that interlocutory summary judgment order, that certainly was ethereal and certainly could be reversed by the district court prior to entry of judgment. At that point, that had moved the plaintiff's case forward.
Thank you, Mr. Legner.
Thank
Our
you,
thanks
Your
to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And